The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Wednesday, the 7th of April, 2021. On the podcast today, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talks about China's dominance in the rare earths market. Plus, he mentions Cornish Metals, Iron Ridge Resources and Serabi Gold. Plus, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, discusses what's likely to make Bitcoin roll over. It's been on a hell of a tear. And in fact, as I'm talking right now, it's down a little bit, sir. 5% down, is it, something like that? But it's certainly, you know, it's failing to get above those previous highs at the moment. So it may be dropping over a bit. No, it's down 4%, sorry. Also on the podcast, at the end of the podcast, I highlight two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most read RNSs too. You can view both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. We'll also see lots of other content. In fact, there's an article there on Cyan Canode. I think that's how I pronounce it. There's one there on Fire Angel. I know it's going crazy gangbusters today. Block Energy as well. Arix, there's one there. Lots of other content. Let's check what the biggest riser is on the COVID-19 index. Biggest riser, about time it had a bounce there. Gene Drive up 10% to 77 pence because it's had a heck of a fall of late. And biggest faller today is down 7% to E Therapeutics. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. And you can also hear John now and again on the BBC World Service of all things. Wow, John, you're getting about. Your voice will be globally recognised.
Yes, well, I do these things from time to time, basically whenever they ask.
Now, I'm only saying this to give myself a bit of a compliment, because you mentioned that Rahul Tandon from the BBC World Service says he's a fan of the podcast, this podcast, and listens quite often. Is that right?
Yeah, no, he likes it. He thinks it's a very professional show. So,
has he got the right podcast? Hang on a sec, what? I think he's got the wrong one, John. But Rahul, if you're listening, thank you very much. It just shows he's a man of quality. See, he works at the BBC, he knows his stuff. And he knows you know your stuff as well. That's what you got. So what were you talking about when you got you on?
We're talking about rare earths and the danger that China, which controls most of the world's rare earth supply and rare earth processing, could create problems and difficulties for Western manufacturers.
Did you watch that documentary afterwards? I recommended on BBC about the New World Order and how silently they are basically creeping into everyone's economy and the power they have, and just also the lack of diversity as far as their thought and how undemocratic they are, basically, as far as the Uyghur population is concerned. All that. So did you watch that, John, documentary? I'd recommend it.
I've not seen that, but we see signs of this all the time. The Chinese are very good metallurgists, and they are lax in terms of environmental compliance and legislation. And so we see that they are able to undercut processing companies around the world. This is not so much on the mining side, but on the processing side. And that's why so many concentrates are exported into China for processing. And then they're able to use the control of processing industries to shall we say, regulate the availability of commodities to Western companies. Now, they did this effectively with Japan over a dispute with certain islands that the Chinese would like to own. And in fact, the Chinese are politically making further claims on those islands. In fact, they've changed the law to allow Chinese fishing boats to carry weapons, and presumably they're going to carry weapons in the area, in the areas around these islands. So what might happen is if Japan tries to defend its territorial rights, it may discover that China cuts off its access to rare earth minerals from China.
Yeah. I'm assuming they're carrying these weapons not to fight with fish, to defend themselves.
Well, the Chinese fishing vessels are encroaching into Japanese territorial waters. And the idea that normal fishing vessels will be, shall we say, semi-militarized with their own weaponry is a very, very dangerous sign from a geopolitical perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talking about growth, I don't know, you say, like I said, in this documentary, they're saying that the trouble is China's responsible for the growth. And I think it was like I saw another figure saying recently about 20% of the global growth now is down to China, And so, to help your economies or countries' economies around the world, they have to do deals with China. And so part of you has to turn a blind eye to the human rights record they have. Or if you don't, you basically don't do deals with them. So, and as they get, bigger and stronger, more powerful, this become increasingly bigger problem, So it's very scary. But so IMF, I've talked about global growth increasing again. All the IMF do essentially, John, is they get it wrong, adjust their figures, get it wrong, adjust their figures, get it wrong, keep adjusting. Is that what they do essentially?
Well, they're always playing catch up with everybody else. They, because I think they have to be more certain about the numbers, that slows them down. But having said that, I think the IMF are a bit more on the front foot at the moment. They've upgraded their expectations for global output this year to 6% and to 4.4% in 2022. And those are quite meaningful upgrades. So, they're saying, look, the world's going to stage a good, strong recovery, and we are going to come out of this. And in fact, a couple of days ago, they also said that they didn't think that the coronavirus crisis was going to be as serious or as long-lasting as the global financial crisis that we saw in developing in 2008.
Yeah. No, I don't think it does, because when you think about it, we've been forced into recession. And of course, that will impact quite a few businesses. There are businesses that have bills still coming in, but they haven't got revenue coming in. But then they've been helped by the government, where you wouldn't have been helped normally in a normal recession. Recessions happen because of contraction. Now, this isn't a normal contraction. So everyone's been, prevented from buying or doing what they want to do. So now you have some people who've actually not been doing stuff, not been taking holidays, not been, buying those big items like the cars or stuff like that, and they've got savings, they're going back to work. So there's a lot of pent-up demand there, and so a lot of companies will benefit from that, won't they? So I think we will, I'm not saying everyone will emerge on this without any financial scars. Some will, of course, but some will benefit greatly, won't they,
Well, the governments and the furlough programs have been a great thing. So, but there's something else going on here. China has been stimulating and supporting its manufacturing for the last 20 years, if not longer. Mm-hmm. The Western world is waking up to the fact that it needs to do the same in order to keep ahead of Chinese manufacturing, in order to remain competitive. Because, of course, remember, China has the benefit of vastly lower wages for your average worker. So the US are going to use quite a lot of the new Biden infrastructure stimulus package, this $2.23 billion infrastructure package, to help American manufacturers get ahead. And I'm of the view that the UK is going to do something similar at some point in time. So we see that governments now are increasingly saying, look, we're going to support you guys, and we've got to advance, and we've got to stay ahead, otherwise China's just going to take over everything. And now that the UK is outside Europe, we are largely unfettered in terms of the support that we can give to our domestic industry in order to try and achieve that.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, well, let's look at some individual company news, John. You're talking about Cornish Metals. You can probably do a very good Cornish accent, John, can't you?
Although I worked in a Cornish tin mine as a young mining engineer, I could not do a Cornish accent. But Cornish Metals have started drilling again at the United Downs project. If you remember, in fact, it was Cornish Lithium who were drilling at that site, who were looking for lithium brines, who actually made the discovery of very high-grade copper and tin in one of the discovery drill holes. It was fantastic. So Cornish Metals, who owned that site and who'd allowed Cornish Lithium to start working on that, are now going in there with some new drill rigs and drilling away. So we look forward to see what those results will be. And at the same time, we've got tin prices rising, which is good, and copper prices hovering just under $9,000 a ton. Very good price levels, and an indication of the strong demand to come.
Yeah, cool. Okay, that's Cornish Metals. Iron Ridge Resources, any news out from those? You mentioned that. Where are they based?
Iron Ridge, well, they're working out in the Ivory Coast and in Ghana.
What's it like there? So I know it's always, when it comes to commodities and resource companies, you know, they're largely based, aren't they? Well, I'd say that, a lot of them are based in Africa, I suppose, but and that's a risk in itself, isn't it?
Well, Africa's a big continent. I mean, frankly, the geology can be
huge
anywhere in the world. You go to where you think the geology is good and where you think you've got a sensible government that you can do business with.
Yeah.
The Ivory Coast and Ghana fit those bills. There's a lot of mining that's happened in Ghana over the years. They're well used to the mining industry.
So what would you say? Where do you say? I mean, you say those two countries. I mean, hard to say. Maybe it's easy to say where you'd avoid or where there's been historic, problems. Currently, obviously, it changes as governments change. But is there any way you'd think? Look now and thinking, it's hard there. It's a bit risky there. Is there any country you'd definitely not, invest in?
Oh well, North Korea and France, frankly.
I was thinking more Africa, but okay. So North Korea, fair enough, and France. But you wouldn't, every place in Africa you'd think is okay. You judge it on its own merits, or is there no avoid list there?
It's difficult and expensive working in the Congo. You wouldn't want to go into the Central African Republic. So there are certain places that you would definitely prefer to avoid. Somalia and the Sudan, very difficult countries. But most countries are relatively okay from a mining perspective. It's just a question. Every country is different from the way you have to approach the minerals licensing situation. I mean, we have our favorites. I mean, I think Zambia is particularly good, for example. But some areas you want to avoid. I mean, you wouldn't want to be in the north of Mozambique right now.
No, I wouldn't. Weather's probably better than here. But cool. And all right. So Iron Ridge. Sorry, what are they doing there, Don?
Well, they're drilling at one of their gold licenses in the Ivory Coast. But the really exciting thing about Iron Ridge is the lithium project that they have in Ghana, and they published a feasibility study on that not long ago. And I think that's a very good quality project. So I think this is a stock to look out for. So you've got a very interesting gold portfolio there, and nice to see they're drilling on that with some sensible, shall we say, chip sampling results that they talked about today. I just think it's an interesting company for people to be aware of.
Yeah, cool. I'm just trying to type in the chart there. Hang on. Let's see how we look on the chart there. It's sort of from 2000. So it started the year at 12.6 pence. It went up to sort of almost 30 pence, but it's coming up to 21 now. So, yeah, it's had a good rise. It zoomed up. I don't know what the news was, but on the 19th of Jan, what was that news? Let me just look it up. 19th of Jan, it went ballistic. Let's sort of go. 19th of Jan.
That would have been on the feasibility study news.
Okay, yeah. They've said, we talked about this actually, and we talked about adjectives in RNS titles, and they said exceptional lithium scoping study results, Ghana. So, but you said that they did have exceptional, is that right?
Yes, I mean, I don't always defend the company, but in this case, yes.
But the exceptional in that regard is a technical description, isn't it? It means above a certain percentage range, doesn't it?
I was asked about this before the announcement actually went out, and in order to verify. Because if a company uses a strong term like that, the nomad or the qualified executive who works for the nomad firm is supposed to double check or be able to verify that exceptional is the right word to use, because it's a particularly strong word. And in this case, yes, they were exceptional results. And I think the net present value of $345 million is quite well supported. And what we've seen is that the price of spodumene has actually gone up quite a lot since they made that announcement, and the price of lithium too. So they're in the right metal at the right time.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Cool. All right. And lastly, magic rule of three, Serabi Gold. What's happening here?
Well, very interested in Serabi today. They've been drilling at the São Domingo project. It's just 8 kilometers west of this, one of their other mines in Brazil. They're quite deep into the Amazon rainforest. I flew in there some years ago to have a look at their operations, and they're pretty slick about how they manage things. But very high grades, 7 meters at 258 grams per ton of gold. That's a high intersection by any standards, and I'm very impressed by that. They've got 3.5 meters at an average grade of 520 grams of ton of gold. Again, that's astonishingly good stuff. So we look forward to Serabi developing yet another mine out there.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. And where's the gold price at the moment? What's it looking like? Is it rallying a bit? Is it bounced off of his last few levels?
Gold, yes, at $1,741 an ounce this morning. It's definitely bounced off recent lows. And I think we're looking for a bit of a recovery in the gold price.
Do you know what? Did we say this last week? I'm sure we mentioned gold. I said that looks like a double bottom there. It looks like that's a good bounce there. I may have been talking to Hummingbird. I think it was the CEO of the chart. Is looking like we've seen, maybe seen a bottom here, good support level. So, yeah, who knows? It may bounce another again, retest, but I think it'll go sideways and then start to grind a bit higher, I think, hopefully.
Well, I think this is rising on the back of the Biden stimulus. Yeah. The Americans are printing more dollars and the dollar is weakening a bit, and that all helps the gold price higher. I think gold had been whacked. There was a big move by smaller investors into Bitcoin. I think that is probably done for now. I'm not going to say what's going to happen to Bitcoin in the future, but it's gone up an awful long way. Yeah. I'm sure there's some profit taking, and probably the money goes back into gold.
Well, I was just talking to a cryptocurrency trader, and I was saying it looks like finally it's rolling over, because we've had a series of higher highs in the price, but on the relative strength index, which is an indicator, it's been lower highs, which means basically each rally is becoming weaker. And this last rally, specifically though, it hasn't even hit a new high. So it did $61,000, and then that was like the 13th of March, and this recent rally it didn't get above 60,000. So that sometimes is telling. When it doesn't get a new high, it's like a lower high. That's a bit of weakness there. So we may see a rollover. I don't know how far it'll go down, but you may see that rotation trade into gold, back into gold, you know, because, I don't know what's happened. Gold seems to have suffered as Bitcoin seemed to have, succeeded, really. Marvellous, or thrived. Marvellous, John. Thanks for that, fella. And we'll speak you next week.
Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenda, the good man. He is the crypto lady. Sorry, Glenn Goodman, the crypto trader. So I always get that wrong. I don't actually. That was a joke at the start.
It's lame.
That's all that was, really. So, Glenn, it's all. I keep thinking, right? I'm looking at the Bitcoin price and thinking, this has got to roll over. It's got to roll over. The signs are showing it's got to roll over. Because I'm just looking at the relative strength. It's formed a series now of higher lows, of lower highs, lower highs. Hello.
Not really series. Let's be fair.
No. Put it on day.
You made one lower high.
No. I'm talking the relative strength. You look at the price.
Oh, you talk about relative
strength. Yeah, I'm going deeper into it than that, Glenn. The momentum.
Oh, so deep.
So if you look like the first rally, I said to 40,000, the relative strength hit 90. Okay, then it came back down to like 43, the relative strength, and the price came down to 30. Then the relative strength went back up to about 79.80, and the price were up to 57,000. Then it came down again to 50, touch that, up again to 70. Each time now, we're getting, so these peaks on the RSI are 87, okay, 80, 69. Now, the recent one, which is just now the second, in fact, the price is now starting to follow the RSI, when it's not made a new high, it only peaked at 50, 60. So the strength of the momentum, and that's what it's about. It's about velocity and volume and price movement. It's all that in one. So that's coming down. So I'm thinking this is a rollover here, isn't it? Rollover Beethoven, rollover Bitcoin here.
It's certainly a possibility. I'm you know, as I said last week, I'm out of Bitcoin and into what I consider
other
coins.
You didn't say that. You said you're in it.
No, I said I'd swapped it for a bunch of other cryptos.
Long and strong.
Yeah, long the market generally, yeah.
Oh, yeah, but changing your rules there,
No, you just weren't listening properly last week.
If I couldn't
you
be
weren't listening.
Yeah, if I wouldn't be bored senseless, I'd go back and listen to it.
I was generally bullish, and so I had decided, just for technical reasons more than anything else, to just swap my Bitcoin for some other cryptos that I felt were more promising at the time. And, you know, so far that's
working out.
Bitcoin is kind of just moving sideways, really. It's more or less back to where it was about a month and a half ago. Whereas Ethereum, on the other hand, has just made a new all-time high, is looking very strong indeed. Also, BNB, Binance coin, has made a massive new high. It's a bit of a mixed bag. There are a lot of cryptos that are behaving like Bitcoin, that look like they might possibly be rolling over. But then there are also others, led by Ethereum, which is still worth nowhere near as much as Bitcoin, but is a pretty hefty crypto in itself. I'm just looking up the current market cap. So it is current.
But hang on a second. Let me ask a question. If Bitcoin rolls over, surely they all just follow, won't they?
Look, Ethereum is a contender now, right? Bitcoin is worth more than $1 trillion, but Ethereum is worth about $250 billion. So it's still, if it was a company, it would still be an absolutely massive company with a market cap of $250 billion. So you could compare it to the stock market and say, look, if Tesla rolls over, surely everything else is just going to collapse. But that isn't necessarily the case. Even though Tesla led the bull market for the last couple of years in the stock market, when it started sputtering, I'll just drag up Tesla's chart to get the dates. But it started sputtering in January, right?
What's sputtering? What is sputtering?
You know, like a car when the exhaust.
No, that's spluttering. It's not sputtering. It's spluttering. It's an L in there.
I think sputter is a word.
Splutter.
Isn't it?
You look at the chart of Tesla.
Sputter is a word, but sputter, if you look it up now, look, I've just looked it up.
It's someone who's forgotten to put the L in the word sputter. That's what the sputter, that's the thing.
Sputter.
It's sputtering,
verb.
Sputtering.
Make a series of soft, explosive, or spitting sounds. E.g., the engine sputtered and stopped.
What about splutter?
You must be feeling a bit stupid right now, I imagine.
No.
That's how I imagine things are in your brain.
It's only
right
come
now.
About because people can't say the word splutter. So it's like a dumbed-down version of the word splutter. A splutter, make a series of short, explosive spitting or choking sounds. Hang on a sec.
What?
They're exactly the same. Splutter, which came first? Sod crypto, sod Bitcoin, which came first? Splutter or splutter?
Okay, well, we'll ask the listeners, and hopefully somebody is a linguist who can answer that one.
The difference between splutter and sputter is that splutter is to spray droplets while speaking, while sputter is to spit or emit saliva from mouth in small scattered portions, as in rapid speaking.
Right.
So,
why did I even mention sputter? I can't remember.
That's right. Thanks for coming on, Glenn.
I was comparing the crypto market to Tesla and the way that Tesla led the stock market upwards. But in January, it started to splutter/sputter. And basically, it hasn't risen since late January. Tesla fell significantly since late January. In fact, it's down, not quite a quarter, but, something like 15-20%. And so in fact, at its worst, it had fallen by well over a quarter, by about a third. But anyway, my point is, though Tesla fell significantly, that doesn't mean that the whole market was going to fall significantly. So what you get
is the rotation,
something else takes over the leadership, right?
I have to drag you back to that.
Yeah.
It's a world away from saying, because Tesla rolled over, the entire market. Tesla is an EV battery play, whereas
it's
crypto
not
is crypto.
EV battery play. Tesla was like.
It's car.
It had become a behemoth that had. That dominated the stock market.
No,
and
it didn't dominate.
No, it didn't.
But also, did have a. But listen, no, it's not. It's very different. Very different sectors. It's a long dated asset class, pretty much, because you know, and that's why it rolled over the bonds. Now, the big, you could say.
I'm stretching the analogy a bit.
Yeah. Because let's be honest, there are thousands
of dominates in a much more significant way than Tesla. Does.
Yeah, what I'm saying is there are thousands of companies completely unrelated to Tesla who will do quite well. Whether Tesla goes bust doesn't matter. But with Bitcoin, if Bitcoin went bust, that would really shake up the market of crypto. The crypto would not all of them would get sucked into the big hole it left, but quite a few would, I suppose, if the confidence in Bitcoin, which is the mummy daddy of the crypto world, then that would. So what I'm saying is, if Bitcoin has a significant rollover, I'm saying here, I'm pinning my face to the flag, whatever the flag to the pole. I don't know. I'm pinning something somewhere, but I'm saying that if Bitcoin rolls over significantly, 10% of the crypto market will feel that. It's like the moon and the tides. They will feel that.
It does. But what I've noticed, the way it works is, within the context of this bull market that started a year ago, that's the starting point, right? We've got a bull market. And even if Bitcoin has a correction, as it does from time to time, it does have a downward pull on other cryptos, but because we're within the context of a larger bull market, that downward pull on other cryptos isn't necessarily long-lasting. So what you tend to get, say Bitcoin falls for a few weeks, right? And then there's another strong crypto, say Ethereum or something else, that has been performing really well. Initially, when Bitcoin starts falling for those few weeks, the other cryptos get dragged down, including Ethereum, and then they will recover much more quickly. So then when Bitcoin has a tiny cyclical upturn that might only last, a day or something like that before it falls even further, those other cryptos will benefit more. And so they will go up a lot more. So what I'm saying is they're able to establish their own bull trends, their own short-term bull trends, even if Bitcoin is within a short-term bear trend, because even though they feel those falls, they don't feel them much, and then they recover very strongly. And then there's another little Bitcoin fall, and it drags them down again a bit, but then they recover even more strongly. So that's kind of the way it works with these smaller cryptos. But I totally agree with you that if Bitcoin were to actually have a proper crash like the one in 2018, I have no doubt at all that it would drag every crypto right down. You know, that would be probably, like it has been in the past, the end of the bull market for all cryptos. And then you'd have another crypto winter like the one we had in 2018, 2019.
Yeah, I don't think it'll last that long now. That's the trouble. There's so much bullishness, isn't there, around crypto. It doesn't last very long, you know? It's all just all going very well, isn't it?
It is. It is all going very well. I mean, you know, we're moaning about Bitcoin here, but it's only a few thousand dollars off its all-time high at the moment. It feels like it's rolling over because it just kind of looks that way on the charts, and the RSI reflects that. But it's still right up there at the top, basically. It's still just oscillating. I mean, when was it? On the 2nd of April, which is only a few days ago, it almost reached its all-time high again.
Yeah, what we need, though, is a big drawdown sometimes, isn't it? Where it really sells off, scares people, and everyone starts selling. And as we know, selling begets selling, apart from the hardened, hodlers. I don't know if they're around anymore. Do they still call them that? They're still hodling.
Yeah, it's kind of less relevant in a bull market, isn't it? The hodlers are the people who hold throughout an 80% or more decline in during a bear market. You know, the hodlers were the people who lost 80 to 90% of their money, or even more if they were in small cryptos. But it's worth mentioning the futures market, because the futures markets tend to dominate the crypto markets now. People buying and selling futures, you know, sort of betting on what the price will be in the future. It's very similar to the way futures markets work in commodities and currencies and indices and all of that. So you've now got your futures markets for cryptocurrencies, and that's where the biggest volumes are. And you can actually get a bit of an indication about how overstretched things are by looking at the funding rates. And that is the interest rate that people pay to borrow money to buy futures. And at the moment, those interest rates are quite high, not as high as I've seen them in recent months, you know, not the highest, but they are quite high, which implies that, or suggests that, there are lots of people rushing into these futures and buying them and bidding up the interest rate to borrow the money. And so that suggests that things are a bit overstretched at the moment. Usually when you get high interest rates in the futures like this, you'll usually get a bit of a shakeout to shake out those futures holders. And so they all kind of get liquidated out of their positions, and then it starts the cycle again.
Right.
So from that perspective, I buy the rollover idea.
Here comes a slick segue. I think one of the things that will, force or make or create a Bitcoin cryptocurrency sell-off is some kind of regulation, Glenn. You know, sometimes you get that coming around where it scares, you know, if a big country like America or something like that, or China, India did it recently, didn't they? But if one of those stands that says, right, we are banning the trading of all, you know, fairy dust cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, that would make a massive difference, because they control the plumbing ultimately. They control, even though governments can't ban Bitcoin, you know, out of existence, because it can always exist as long as there are networks of computers willing to cooperate with each other and keep a blockchain going. As long as there are computers that, you know, will host the blockchain effectively, then Bitcoin still exists. But what they can do is ban the fiat currency to crypto transfers. So, you know, say Coinbase was banned from allowing anybody to buy Bitcoin with dollars, you know, to transfer Bitcoin from their bank, dollars rather, from their US bank accounts,
yes,
and convert it into Bitcoin. If the US government banned that, that would be pretty bad.
Yeah, they can put tighter controls on anyone sort of on the exchanges and all that sort of stuff. There was a slick segue there, because you had a bit of news.
Didn't
sound so slick now, though, because I've had to ask you to, you know, to.
Well, you announced it was a segue at the beginning, so you kind of ruined it anyway. But yeah, what we're seeing is a number of important people sort of opining on this. And I keep a close eye on it, because for the long term, at least for the long term health of Bitcoin, we need to know whether the thing's going to get banned or not. It doesn't particularly matter for short term trading, but it does matter in the long run. So, interesting article from Neil Ferguson, the former Harvard professor. I think he's now a Stanford. Yeah, he's a Stanford professor now. You know, highly respected economist, has obviously written loads of best-selling books and that kind of thing. He is of the opinion that the US government isn't going to ban Bitcoin. Here are his comments from a Bloomberg article he wrote. He says, Bitcoin and Ethereum, as well as a great many other digital coins and tokens, are stateless money. And the more they can perform at least two out of three monetary functions tolerably well, the less that banning them is going to work. Unless every government agrees to do simultaneously, which seems like a bit of a stretch. The US isn't going to ban Bitcoin, he says. They're just going to tax it whenever you convert bitcoins into dollars.
Yeah.
So that's what he reckons, that they'll take advantage of it.
Listen, the government are worse than the mafia for squeezing money out of people. You know, they are worse than the mafia. Absolutely worse than the mafia. That, you know, you'd have the boss, the godfather, would be shot if he tried to extort as much money at every turn as the government do. So, for example, I earn money, for example, you know, my income, that is taxed, okay? Then you go to the shops or something, you buy some stuff, VAT is on that. And then I put petrol in a car, there's a huge tax, it's like 70% you know, excise duties on the petrol. So the car itself is taxed. You know, there's a tax disc on the car. If I drive certain roads, you have to pay to go on those roads or something. You know, certain different size cars are taxed. Everything's taxed. No matter where you go. If I buy a house, stamp duty. If I sell a house, capital gains tax. Is it, you're taxed at every turn. You can't do anything. So the way governments are going to see this is, hang on a sec, hang on. People are making money out of this. We're not. That's what the government's going to say. We want to make some money out of this. Mm. Full stop. That's all they'll say. And in the end,
they
want a cut of it. They want to, you know, they want to wet their beak a little bit.
Well, here's the interesting, an interesting opposing argument from Ken Rogoff. Don't know if you've heard of him. Yeah. He's another Harvard economist. Yeah, he's. I mean, he's enormously respected. If you look up Ken Rogoff, one of the most common articles is, why hasn't Ken Rogoff won a Nobel Prize yet? It's like, it's just a big surprise to everybody that he hasn't won a Nobel Prize because he's that establishment. He's very, very establishment. And because he's very establishment, even more so than Neil Ferguson, I tend to listen to what he says. And he's done an interview with Newsweek where he says the following, which is quite worrying. He says, supporters of Bitcoin may be able to buy off some politicians in the short run, but everybody's looking at this. Every treasury. I've had regulators tell me, look, for the moment, there's innovation coming out of this crypto space, but if we ever start seeing a lot of transactions in our country, we're going to crack down. But for the moment, we're proceeding cautiously. And then the Newsweek interviewer adds, ultimately, Rogoff believes governments around the globe are likely to ban retail establishments from using Bitcoin and outlaw financial establishments from taking it. So that is very contrary to what Neil Ferguson was saying. And what's interesting about this is he's focusing on transactions. He believes that as long as Bitcoin stays as it is at the moment, as a kind of curiosity, as an alternative version of gold, then governments won't care much about it. Even though Bitcoin is now a $1 trillion market, governments still aren't that bothered because it's like, oh, gold is what, a $10 trillion market? And, you know, it doesn't bother governments. They don't go, oh, the threat of gold. We're so scared of gold. It could kill the dollar. They're not scared, right? And likewise, they're not scared of Bitcoin. But what would scare them is if people actually started using Bitcoin for transactions to buy their cup of coffee, to buy anything, really. So if they started seeing it used as actual money, because they don't see it as money at the moment, but if they start seeing it as real money, then they'll get scared, and that's when they might take steps to outlaw it.
Yeah, do you know what? It's funny. People are already creating a defence. I mean, one of the biggest things at the moment, isn't it, and against Bitcoin, is climate change and the amount of electricity it uses and the carbon footprint. You know, it's very big, and people are trying to come up with clean ways of, you know, creating this energy. But I retweeted an article. I think it was from The Independent, saying that the downfall of Bitcoin would probably be climate change, you know, unless they change what they're doing, the footprint. And already I had loads of rehearsed arguments coming back at me from Bitcoiners saying, well, look how much big the carbon footprint is of banks and all that, and fiat currency being created and all that. I thought, well, hang on a sec. I didn't bother arguing on Twitter because you did no point. But we don't use Bitcoin as a currency. We do use banks to move that currency and money around. So it's a lot. The banks and their systems are a lot more important than Bitcoin. But already these Bitcoiners think, you know, it's a currency. It's not a currency. It's too volatile to be a currency. Like I said, you could pay something now with a Bitcoin and it could be half the price or double the price in a month's time. So you're never going to use it as a currency. So maybe it's a store of value. But
well, their argument is if it became a currency,
yeah, I know, but that's
then
ridiculous.
It would be justified to use all that energy because it would be performing a useful function.
Well, I'm disagree with Ken. I think essentially governments will let you do it as long as it's not creating too many problems. But by even taxing it in some way, It'll
you're agreeing with Ken, not disagreeing with Ken.
Neil was saying
that they would tax it. Rogoff is saying that they'll just leave it alone. Well, I mean, they already do tax it. They tax transactions.
The US
government, the UK government, in fact, every major government has now got rules about declaring your Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency transactions in the same way that you do stocks and shares. So they're already
I don't, because the thing is, all mine's an ISA, so they don't get taxed. But you can't have cryptos in ISA. So what's going to happen is, I think governments just want to get money. Most governments, you know, in debt, they want more money, and that's what they want. They think it's an opportunity to make money, and it'll be taxed to the point where it becomes a very boring investment, pretty much like any other investment, and it'll be so much tax on it, it loses attraction. That sort of Wild West of investing, the new frontier. It won't be like that anymore. It'll just be a tax, asset or commodity, whatever it is. And it'll just become boring and mainstream, And then something else will take its place. Like, at the moment, I think it's NFTs, isn't it? All that stuff. So,
Well, NFTs are a type of cryptocurrency, or they're based on cryptocurrency technology anyway. So it's all connected. It's all one and the same. This big crypto world is going to transform a lot of things. I still believe that, but that's because it actually is happening. Slowly but surely. The DeFi movement will probably at some point not necessarily kill all the banks, but it will displace a lot of their old technology and replace it with DeFi technology. Whether the companies themselves, the old school banks, still exist or not is another question. They might not.
Yeah. Right,
if they
Glenn.
Can adapt in time. I see the clock has turned to 11. It's time for me to stop rambling, is it?
Yeah, well, that was...
Is that right?
It was time for that, a long time ago. But, yes, marvellous stuff. Glenda, have you got any other final word? By that I mean word. That's it, is it? Okay, cool, excellent, Glenn, thanks for that. We'll speak to you next week. I thought you could have picked a more significant word there, but there we are. Is it? Cheers.
Yeah, that'll do.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They're at five on Commune Holdings. In fact, it's worth checking out an interview with Paul Hill and Dr. Adam Hill. No relation. And I'm sure Dr. Adam Hill would like to state that categorically. There's no relation there whatsoever. the interview between Paul Hill and Dr. Adam Hill, CEO of OnCommune Holdings, there on the podcast, on the website, voxmarkets.co.uk. At four, Deliveroo. Is it on for a bounce? Some people are trading it, by the looks of it. Up 3%, 286.3. Of course, very disappointing IPO. Fell at 30% at one point. At three, Shield Therapeutics. It's down half of 1%, 45.25. At two, Oilex, down 10%, 0.33. And at one, My Health Checked PLC. That is up 2.7%. Good afternoon, RNS. They've done a deal with Boots for COVID testing. And that's at 5.6 pence. Okay, top five most read RNSs are as follows. At five, Cimec, Atlantis Energy, operational update. At four, MGC Pharmaceuticals, Artempic, rescue first delivery and March revenue. At three, UK Oil and Gas, formal drilling consent for Bassa 3 granted. At two, 40 Pharma, how to convert AIM ordinary shares into NASDAQ ADS. And at one, Argo Blockchain, March and Q1 operational update. And of course, let's have, are they up on that or are they down on that? Let's look. Probably because it's rolling over a little bit. But no, it's up a smidge there. That's the most read. ARB is ticker there, Argo Blockchain, one of my early sellouts where I could have made a killing. But I didn't. It killed me. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.